Harry.
I wanted to do another area in Tanakh. I'm sure you're probably basically familiar. I'll give you some of the general background, then I'll focus in on the specific thing that I want to take up. If you're familiar with the story of Shmuel, you know that at the beginning of his career as a Navi, his career as a Navi. So the Jews, this is before the Jews had done Tshuva. But the Chet of Avodah Zarah, that time they were still involved in that faith. Anyhow, they went out. They went out and they did. They fought a war against the Pelishtim. That's in Shmuel Aleph Perek Dalet. And they went out and they fought a war against the Pelishtim. And it says that they were smitten. 4,000 men were killed. So then the this is Pasuk Gimel. The Jews. Vayomer Aharon el Hamachne. The people came to the camp. Vayomer Zikni Yisrael. The Zikni Yisrael said, Lama Nigafanu Ad Hashem Hayom Lifnei Plishtim. Why has God smitten us today before the Plishtim? Nikra Eleinu Mishilo as Aron Bris Hashem. Let us take from Shiloh. At that time, the Mishkan was in Shiloh. This is before they built the Beis Hamikdash. The Aron Bris Hashem. The Yavo Bikirbenu. The Yoshienu Mikafei Venu. So you know they brought the Aron to the battlefield. They thought that the Aron would save them. All right, so then I can't go through the entire story. The when the people saw the Aron, they let out a great roar, a great scream, and the Pelishtim heard it, and they were very much afraid because they had heard about all the makos that God had done in Mitzrayim. But nevertheless, they fought, and it turned out that the Jews suffered a tremendous slaughter. And the two sons, this is the two sons of Eli, were killed. Two sons of Eli were killed, and the Aron was captured by the Pelishtim. So this was a tremendous tragedy, tremendous catastrophe in the history of the Jews. In fact, somebody came back from the battlefield to report. Eli was sitting waiting for a report. He was an old man at the time, and the pasuk said they told him all three events. They told him that the Jews were his two sons had been killed, and the Jews suffered a great defeat, and the Aron was captured. And when he heard about the Aron, he fell off the chair and he was killed. So the capture of the Aron was the worst of all the tragedies. All right. Then what happens next? Then the Tanakh tells us the story of the Aron in the hands of the Pelishtim. What did the Pelishtim do? Are you familiar with the story? Yeah, they put it in the same room with their Avodah Zarah, which was called Dagon, because it was in the shape of a fish. That was their idol. All right. There's a machlokas in Chazal, in other words, whether they meant to say that it was weaker than Dagon. One view is that because they held that the each nation had its own god, and whoever won in victory, so that showed that their god was victorious. Some say that no. Some say that they put it there side by side. They said this is a god and this is a god. No, they're both a god. Whatever it is. So you see that God performed certain miracles. In other words, they woke up the next day and they saw that Dagon was prostrated and was lying down before the Aron.
Yeah, it was knocked off its pedestal.
It was knocked off its pedestal. That was the first sign. But nevertheless, they put it back in its place. They didn't take it to heart. What happened the next morning? That the hands, it was nothing but a stub. The hands and the, right? And what, the legs?
There's only the palms of his hands.
Yeah, the rest had been Rosh Dagon and his two hands, rather. I guess he didn't have legs. It just was the shape of a fish. The head of Dagon and the two hands were cut off. Okay?
The pieces there?
Yeah. In other words, the pieces were there. So this was a further sign that there's something wrong here, right? And nevertheless, that wasn't sufficient. Then it said that God smote them with tremendous plague. Hemorrhoids. There's different exclamations in Chazal. With hemorrhoids, some say with mice. Mice would enter into their bodies. And bad news. Bad maka.
Yeah,
yeah,
it says
they're
inwardly struck with swelling. That must be hemorrhoids.
Hemorrhoids, and also it's an akvarim. Would enter into their bodies and their intestines and chew them out, you know. It was kind of tough. It was a message, to be sure. It was a message there. But anyways, so I'm not going to go through that. You have to go through that yourself. You'll see the whole... They call the leaders of the Plishtim, and the Plishtim got together, and they said, we'll take it to a different city. You know, Akron and Aza, different cities. And wherever it went, there was tremendous plagues, tremendous catastrophe. So finally, they decided that time to give the Aram back. Things are not going. This is not for us, right? In fact, they said, it's interesting. They said that why should we be like the Mitzrim? The Mitzrim hardened their heart, and they were smitten. Why should we be that way? Well, let's be. So they called together their religious leaders, their kosmim, and they asked them, how should we send it back? You see, there were two kinds of leaders. They had their political leaders and their religious leaders. So the kosmim devised a whole plan to build a special cart, and with oxen that had never been used before, and gold offerings in the shape of achbarim, and so forth, a mincha, to send it back with a tremendous amount of kavod and a mincha. And they said to just put the aron on the cart and let it go by itself, and we'll see. You see, even at that point they weren't entirely convinced. It just goes to show you that all of these various events, a person can always say, well, perhaps it's an unknown cause. We don't know. It could be that there's a natural explanation for this. Nevertheless, the trend was, the smart thing to do was to send it back. But they said, then we'll know. If it goes straight to the Jewish border, so then we'll know that all this was in the hand of God. If it doesn't, it goes off the course, whatever it is, so we'll know that everything that happened was a mikrah, was part of nature, and we don't understand the cause. You see, even after all the suffering and everything, they weren't 100% sure. So what happened? They put it on the they put the urn on the cart, and the cart went straight, without going to the left or the right, to the city of Beis Shemesh, which was the closest the border, a Jewish city. Okay. Now, what I want to really take up is what took place in Beis Shemesh. I'm just giving you this as background. So what happened in Beis Shemesh? It's interesting. It says, "Beis Shemesh kosim katir chitim ba'emek." And the people of Beis Shemesh were reaping the wheat in the valley. Vayisu was a Nahem, and they lifted their eyes, Vayiros Aron, and they saw the Aron, Vayisbuchuliros, and they rejoiced to see. Then it says that they offered sacrifices and took down the Aron, and so on and so forth. And then at the end of the description of what the people of Beis Shemesh did, then it says in Pasuk Yitzchak, Vayach b'yanshe Beis Shemesh, and God smote the people of Beis Shemesh. Ki ro'u ba'aron Hashem, because they had seen the Ark of God. Vayach ba'am shiv mish, chamishim elef ish. And he smote of the people
50,000.
Vayisavlu ha'am. That they didn't do. Vayisavlu ha'am, and the people mourned. Ki hika Hashem ba'am mach gedola. Because the people had because God had smitten the nation, a great blow.
A great smite.
Question of the shear is, what was the chait of the Anshei Beis Shemesh? Then, of course, they sent it on to Kiryas Yearim. No. They sent it there to Kiryas Yearim, and it stayed there for 20 years, and the people began to do tshuva. This was the real turning point in the tshuva. I mean, everything that happened was the result of God's hashkacha. But my question is, what was the chait? What does it mean? It says God smote them, and because they looked at the Aron. So there's a number of different pshatim. I want to concentrate on the pshat of the Radak. The Radak, there's two Radaks over here. One Radak is Vayismuchu Leros. They rejoiced to see. He said, Achem Erov Simcha. He says, this pasuk contains the clue of their sin. He says, up to the point that, because of their great Simcha, Pirtu Leros Ba'aron. They were bold to look at the Aron, upaschu, and they opened it up, ro, masha besocha, what is inside of it? Lefichach nanshu, therefore they were punished. Kamosha kasev, as it says in the pasuk, it's openly in the Torah. V'lo yavo liros, they should not come to see, kavalas ha-kodesh v'mesev. When they uncover the kodesh, and they'll die. So he says, we're going to go into that pasuk in a minute. He says, this is stated openly in the Torah, that this is a chait, to take a look at the Aron, when it's uncovered, and they violated it, and therefore they died. Later on, it says in the pasuk Yiro'u Ba'aron. No, he brings down the other pshat in Chazal. I'm not going to go. Some said they spoke disparagingly about the Aron. They were critical. How come it didn't protect us? Some say that they didn't stop their work in honor of the Aron. What a different pshat. But I'm concentrating on the pshat. The chait was that they looked at the Aron. And
what about the fact that they sacrificed?
Sacrificed. There wasn't Bamos or Wamuta because there was no Mishkan. Now, there was no Beis HaMikdash. Mishkan Shiloh was destroyed.
Right.
He says, Vanachon, he brings down all the other Pshatim and the Radak on your test. Vanachon Masha Pirashnu. The correct Pshat is the way we explained it. Shapaskul also, they opened it. Vero Masha Besocho. Lefika Chama Bi'aron. Therefore it says, Ba'aron, Velo Ama Aron. In other words, it says, Kiro Ba'aron Hashem. The word Ba implies they looked into it. Now the question is, what is the Chayt over here? Yeah, what's wrong with that? Let's take a look at the source. That's at the end of Bamidbar, Perek Dalad, a pasuk Yedzayin, the parsha. It says, "Adavar Shalom Moshe Velaron Leimor Al Tachrisu Hashevet Mishpachos Akasi Mitoch Alavim." Do not cause the shevet of the families of Kahas to be cut off amongst Levim. This is at the Bamidbar Dalad, the Maftir in Bamidbar. V'zos asu lahem, this is what you should do for them, v'chayu v'lo yamusu, and they'll live and not die, v'gishtam es kodesh hakadashim, when they approach the Holy of Holies. Aaron uvan of Yavo, Aaron and his children shall come, v'samu osam ishe shalom adasa v'yamaso, you'll appoint each man according to his avoda, his job, v'lo yavo liros, they shall not come to see, kavala es hakadosh v'mesu. Kavala es HaKodesh. The question is, what does it mean, Kavala es HaKodesh? So there are different shatim that are brought down. It's not exactly clear what the word means, Kavala es HaKodesh. And I'll just quote to you briefly the Ramban. I have the English here, so I'll just read it to you. He says, he quotes Rashi, that it means, Kavalah means, as they, the Kohanim, put each vessel into its wrapping, as I have explained above in this section, and they shall spread upon it such and such a garment, and they shall cover it with such and such a cover. The term Kavalah referring to its covering. Rashi learns Kavalah means when they cover it, but they shouldn't see when they cover the Kalim. This is Rashi's language, the Ramban says. It is also Unkelus's opinion. But our rabbis have said in the tractate Sanhedrin that this verse constitutes a prohibition against stealing a sacred vessel, for which one suffers death by the hand of heaven. And zealous people have the right to strike such a thief, for stealing and robbing are referred to as belia, swallowing. That's the din of Kanoim Pogimbo. Then he says like this, but Rabbi Abraham Ibn Ezra explained the verse in its plain sense, that the Levium should not come in to see when the screening veil is removed, and the ark becomes exposed. Only afterwards, when it is covered, are they to come in to carry it. Accordingly, the expression Kavala es HaKodesh means they shall not come in to see when the structure, that is, the screening veil, is being removed from the ark, which is the holiness. Okay? And he says, I'm sorry? This is Ibn Ezra. Thus the Levites are warned not to touch the holy ark lest they die, and only by means of its staves are they to carry it. He furthermore warned them against coming in at all to see the dismantling of the structure while Aaron is taking down the screening veil, in a similar way to that which is said of the people of Beit Shemesh, that they were punished because they had gazed upon the Ark of the Eternal. Ah, he says there are two things that are prohibited. One is to touch the Ark, and also they are not allowed to look at it when the screening veil is removed from it, and he says, this is the sin of the people of Beit Shemesh. He, Ibn Ezra, has explained it well. Alright? So he likes that shot. Alright, then he adds something else, another idea. So, basically, this is the shot of the Radak. This is the way the Radak learns. That, well, Yavo Liros Kavalas HaKodesh means that it's usher for them to see the Aron when it's uncovered. And for that, Yechayim Nisa. Now the question is, philosophically, what's wrong with it? What's wrong with looking at the what's the terrible thing? That they're chayiv misa. Must be a very serious chait. That's the question that I wanted to take up today. The case is, I think there are a few. Please. I think the real source. I agree with the approach that you fellows have been taking. Not the approach you're taking, either. I don't agree with that. I think the approach is. Please. I think the approach is based upon the fact that when Moshe Rabbeinu came down and he saw the ego, what did he do? He broke the luchos. Now, he broke the luchos. And the Chazal say that God said to him, Yashkech, give me Yashkech for doing the right thing. And the question is, why did he break the luchos? Why did he break the luchos? No, at this point, you could say that he saw that the people weren't on the proper level to receive the luchos. So he should have just not given it to them. But what was the purpose of actually breaking the luchos? And why did God actually endorse it? Yashkech, it means to say that it was the correct, in that situation, the correct thing to do was to break the luchos. Yes, Nathalie?
Okay.
See, what's the connection? What was the cheta ego?
The cheta ego was
there? Really, it doesn't mean, they didn't hold, you know that, they didn't hold the ego itself. Yeah, but it meant that in terms of the nature of their relationship, they were going from the abstract relationship to God to the psychological. See, the psychological relationship to God, in other words, relating to God through the psychological, that is the projection of a father figure, right, that requires an object. You see? So Moshe Rabbeinu saw that they had a need for objects. And they could not, they weren't on the level that they could relate to God in the intellectual way, in the abstract way. And that was the God of the universe, the creator. Without any, the motive power to create the idol rests in the psychological need for the father figure. That's a totally different approach to God. So when Moshe Rabbeinu saw that, he saw that since they have a need for objects, as you see illustrated by the fact they created the ego, so then there's a tremendous danger. I mean, they'll take the aron, right? Which the aron is really it's a halachic object. Halachic object is a totally different kind of a concept. And it's ksuv v'yetzba elokim. There's a tremendous danger that they'll begin to relate to it as an object. They'll imbue it with certain properties, characteristics, powers, and so forth. So therefore, it was essential that he smash it to show that it's nothing. It's not the physical luchos that are anything. The physical luchos are nothing. The real, the essence, in fact, that's the case by every object of mitzvah. There's a danger, in other words. Every object of mitzvah could be, you see there is a tremendous, by the way, you see there is a tremendous emotion in people to look for these kind of objects. Where do you see it today?
Mezuzah,
but you see the Western Wall. The wall. The wall. I mean, it's a shrine. Tremendous, it has a tremendous hold on people. To go, there's something in that wall itself. They put notes in the wall. Well, what's the whole idea? Right? It's really rooted in that emotion. The emotion is what? Is to find an object. To find an object that has, of course, lie. They consciously are not going to say that they believe it can do such and such, consciously. But unconsciously, there's something there. Something in that object, the physical. In other words, I'm sorry, they're taking something which is not supposed to be a physical object. It's the essence of the, and this is true of all mitzvahs, the essence of the chefta shel mitzvah is not the physical thing itself. The essence is the halachic concept. Because, you see, any halachic object, you make a certain change, it no longer is has to be done in a purely conceptual thing. Every halachic object is a purely conceptual thing. Right? So one second. So that's why Moshe Rabbeinu had to break it. That's why he had to break it. Now what was the story over here? What happened over here? You see, why was the Aron taken from them in the first place? You see that the capture of the Aron was also dictated by Hashkacha. Why was the Aron captured? Why did God cause the Aron to be taken away from them? And since people was, the reason why it was taken away was because of the nature of their relationship to the Aron itself. You see that in the when they were smitten, right? So what does it say? How did they react when they were smitten? They said, "Lama nigafanu Hashem ayom lufnei plishtim." Why? That was good. They asked a good question. Why did God cause this? And as they realized that it was a result of Ashkecha, they were being smitten. Now, what was wrong with the answer? Nicha Eleinu Mishilo Asaron Bris Hashem V'yavu B'kirbeinu V'yoshienu Mikafei Veinu. What was wrong? They looked at the wrong thing. Instead of looking, what should they have looked at?
Themselves.
They asked the right question. The question was, why should we be smitten? The answer is, it's not because you don't have a certain object present. The answer is, it's because of your imperfections. It's your defect. The defect is really in yourself. And the entire purpose of the Aron is to be a symbol of certain ideas, and you have to incorporate those ideas and live according to it, and then the Ashkacha will relate to you. That's the true concept. Instead of that, they didn't put the blame on themselves. No, it's because we don't have that object here. And if we just bring, in other words, they thought that if they could just bring that object to the battlefront, right? Of course, it's a little bit strange. If the object has powers, why can't it work from Shiloh? Why does that have to be over there? Whatever it is, they thought that by bringing the object to the battlefront, that would make the whole difference. In other words, they were changing the nature of the, they were endowing. They were endowing the object with certain properties. And that's why the Aron had to be taken away from them. In fact, it's very, very similar. It's really a forerunner to the ultimate destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Where's the Eved HaTilim over here? Perikai and Test in Tehillim. Mizmar La'asaf. A song to Asaf. Elokim. Bo Goyim Banach Lasecha. Timu Etecha Kochecha. Samu Es Yerushalayim Le'im. It's a hymn of Asaf, right? Describing the fact that they've destroyed the and they've made Tameh the Beis HaMikdash, the structure of the Beis HaMikdash. So Rashi asks a very good question. He says, Umahu Mizmar, what's the Mizmar? V'halo kinah, it should be a dirge. Mizmar means a song, a hymn, like a happy thing. Praise. V'halo kinah. He says, El Lefisha Nemar Kola Hashem Es Chamaso. It says in Eicha, right, that God has vented his anger. Uvamekala, Vayotes Eish, B'tzion, Mizmor V'shirhu. It's a Mizmor and a Shir. It's a song. Sheshafa Chamaso Aleitim Yalavanim. That God vented his anger on stone and on wood. V'lo Asa Kli Abimanav. And he didn't destroy his children. What does it mean? What's the idea? It's really a song, he's saying. The fact that God destroyed the Beis HaMikdash is really a praise. It's really a good thing. Because he took out his anger on the building rather than on the children. And what kind of idea is that? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, God doesn't operate that way. He got angry. He had another. It's like, it sounds like a person. Person gets angry, he needs something. He needs to take it out on someone. So it's a good thing somebody else is there. He got it. I was saying. What does it mean? See, it means like this. Oops. I'm sorry. Yeah, because it means like this. It means that at a certain, it's like a double-edged sword. There are many things in Yahadus that are a double-edged sword. That the pshat is that they can be for the good. If they're used properly, they can be for the good. But if they're not used properly, it's not the pshat that they don't achieve the good, but they can be very, very destructive also. And that's precisely the point. You see, the Mikdash could be a source which could lead them to the good, which could lead them to perfection. But if the Mikdash is used improperly, then not only does it not lead to perfection, but it can actually help them, it could actually be a stumbling block. It could actually help them in corruption. Why? Because when they had the Mikdash, they had a tremendous sense of security. In other words, they can go, you know, they became corrupt, and they became involved in the material, so people could go out and sin, do whatever they please. And then they come to the Mikdash, bring the sacrifices, and everything is fine. As long as they had the physical Mikdash to be mechaper for them, that's the way they related. In other words, they related it to it as an object, that you bring the sacrifices, and the sacrifices will atone for you. So then the very presence of the Mikdash became an obstacle. And in order to put them in the proper state, that whole institution had to be destroyed. And if the institution wouldn't have been destroyed, then they would have had to be destroyed. In other words, that's what it means, that that he destroyed the object rather than destroy them. That meant that if the only way that they could be saved was through the destruction of the object. So you see that the object, right, when they related to the Mikdash, not as a conceptual thing, but as a physical process. It has certain powers. You bring the carbon, and bing, you get the mechaper, When they reached that level, then it was an obstacle to their perfection. That's summed up in the, I think it's in, which is the Navi that says, Ki Yisharim Darchei Hashem, that whole idea, the double-edged sword. Ki Yisharim Darchei Hashem, because Yashar means straight, righteous are the ways of God. Tadikim Yelchuba, the righteous thrive, go in them. Uposhim Yikashluba, but the sinners stumble therein. What does it mean, but the sinners stumble therein? What does it mean? It means that the Darkei Hashem, the Torah, for the person who is righteous. So Yelchuba, he thrives. But for the one who is not, for the person who is corrupt, you see that the Torah could be a stumbling block. The Torah could be a stumbling block. In other words, the person that approaches the Torah with the wrong motivations, then it's a stumbling block. He could be, why? Because he's very self-satisfied. He'll never look at perfecting himself in the sense of true perfection. He does all the rituals, you know what I mean? He goes to shul, he does the rituals, he does the proper things, and he feels a tremendous self-righteousness. He a tremendous sense he's pleasing God, he's doing the right things, he has the favor of God. Meanwhile, he can go about and do whatever he pleases in his life. There's no motivation to really to seek genuine perfection. In other words, if the person relates to the Torah as religion, then the Torah could be a stumbling block. He'll never really look at the self. He has no motivation to look at the self. He's very satisfied. He feels he's a big Torah. That's what it means, uposhim yikashluba. That poshim, sinners, are actually, will stumble therein. The Torah will be a stumbling block for them. Yeah. That was the so what was the chait of the people of Beis Shemesh? What was the chait? The chait was that they looked. He wants to try to, I want to tie this whole thing in. How does this tie into looking? We're saying we just discussed that there are two ways that you can relate. There are two ways that you can relate to the Aron. Either you can relate to it in its true sense, that it's a halacha, it's a conceptual thing. Yeah, you can relate to it in a conceptual manner. Or what? The other way is that you're relating to it as a physical object and you endow it with certain properties, which is based upon the primitive religious mentality. Now, where's the raya? Where do we see a raya about looking? Where do you see the true definition of what looking is? Ashes Lot. From the wife of Lot. Very good. Go ahead. Explain.
What?
Of the sin of Ashes Lot. What was the sin of Ashes Lot? Yeah, that she looked back. So, I mean, it's very... What? All right, let me... You heard it, obviously. For those who didn't. It was like this. That, Ashes Lot looked back. They told her, don't look back. She looked back, and she was turned into a pillar of salt. Of course, it doesn't seem to make much sense. Why salt? All right, so briefly, Chazal say. I'm going to stay on the chat very briefly. Those who want to... There's a tape on this. Those who want to go through it in a step-by-step way with all the information, there's a tape on this. Subject. I'm just going to give you a b'kitzur. That, Chazal say that she was turned into a pillar of salt because when she served guests, she withheld the salt. So since she withheld the salt, so she herself was turned into a pillar of salt. So of course, aside from the fact that what does this mean? I mean, it's a strange kind of justice. In other words, not giving you salt, you turn into salt. But this seems to go against the meaning of the flame shot. The flame shot of the pasuk is that she was turned into a pillar of salt for looking back, not because she didn't give salt. So the answer is like this, that really... There were three groups of people in Sodom. They were the people of Sodom. In other words, the decree of Hashem was that all the inhabitants of Sodom should be destroyed. What does it mean, inhabitants? All those who partook of the midos of Sodom. In other words, that they were abused. In other words, the stranger. They preferred totally against doing any kind of chesed. There, and you see that that's the way they treated the three malachim that came. So that's why was Lot saved? Because Lot was different. Lot wasn't really, he just lived there, but he wasn't an inhabitant. He wasn't part of Sodom. He didn't have the midos of Sodom. That's why he was saved. So you had two categories, the people of Sodom on one hand, and then you had Lot. Now what about Ashes Lot? The Ashes Lot was really a borderline case. That's what Chazal is telling you. That's what it means when it said she would feed the guests, but she'd withhold the salt. What is that real? What are they really saying? That really she had a conflict. That she did not... She was capable of doing the correct action, but the withholding of the salt stemmed from a certain psychological thing. In other words, that psychologically she really did identify with some. In other words, it bothered her. She really did not want to do the act of chesed completely. So that's how the conflict expressed itself. So therefore, there had to be a special... In other words, those who were part of some had to be killed. Those who weren't had to be saved. But what about Aishas Lo? So Aishas Lo was a borderline case. Therefore, the Malachim gave her an opportunity to raise herself to a higher level. Her chait was that to a certain extent she did identify with Sodom. So therefore, the command to her was to break your identification, break your attachment. That's what they mean, don't look back. Why is that looking back? What does looking back indicate? See, looking back is rooted in what? The emotional curiosity. See, she has to see because she identifies. So you see from that, and which is, that was the thing, that was her chait. Her chait was what? That she looked back. The fact that she looked back showed that she, that part of her that identified with Dom overcame the other part. She could not break the attachment to Dom.
Wouldn't anybody be curious to see what was going on?
It's in the play. See, yes, right. Curiosity sense of identification.
Is in the next puzzle, it says Vayashkev Abraham awoke in the morning on the plane. So he was curious, but it was an intellectual curiosity, you know, what is God's justice? But not you see a house burned down, you say, who is that? Your neighbor. But you want to know what's going on intellectually. In her case, it was just an emotional type of looking. So the emotional type of looking means that she really identified with those people. She was really part of that.
Why could she? She was told not to look back. Why could she not follow the... You didn't have to look back. You see, it was a powerful... It wasn't just... You see, it was a very powerful emotional desire to look back. And that has to be rooted in some psychological force. See? If she didn't have that identification, then she could have... so what? Big deal. Nothing. It doesn't mean anything to her. Just turns her back on and walks away. You see?
That could have been a mitigating factor
here. What's the pshat that they looked? Vayismuchuliros. You see that when they saw the return of the Aron, so they had a great sense of joy, but they had to look. What does the looking show? The looking was rooted in the this is the fantastic object. You see, they had to see. Why did they have to see? In other words, like a celebrity or a star, people go back. They just want to catch a glimpse. Why? Because they endow the person with certain qualities. The same thing. The need to look at the Aron was rooted in that emotional. They still had not done a tshuva from that concept of relating to the Aron. It was rooted in that emotional curiosity that there's something in this object per se. That's why they have to see it. So you see, that's precisely the reason for the mitzvah. Why did the Torah command us for law that they should not look at the? Why did the Torah command us not to look at the Aron? The not looking is a demonstration of what? That the essence of the object is not the physical thing per se. It says by Moshe Rabbeinu, when he saw the snare, right? And he heard the voice of God, by Yaster Moshe Panav, that Moshe covered up his face. Why did he cover up his face? To show that God cannot be related to through the senses. That is purely an abstract thing. Can only relate to through the mind. See? What? Right. Kiyori.
So the pray that if we look at the bush,
covering the face is a demonstration. You see, a demonstration that God cannot be related to through the senses. What's that? That's the pshat. The pshat over here is that's the reason for the prohibition. That's the whole thing of touching. Also, you see, the Ramban also mentions together with this that you're not allowed to touch it, because what's touching?
Yeah.
Touching also, you touch the eye. In other words, you see all these things to be in physical contact with the object, right? To grasp it, to touch it, to see it, it's all rooted in one thing. It's rooted in the premise that it's the object per se which has certain powers. As you see, what do people do? They go to the wall and they touch the wall, right? They hug it, they try and touch it. In other words, because they feel that there's something in this object per se. And that's true with many other objects of mitzvah. People want to have a mezuzah around their necks and they want to touch it. They touch it for good luck, right? In other words, when people relate to things in that way, then they have to have a physical relationship to the object. See, when they have made the object into a physical thing, then they want to have a physical relationship to the object. And that is the touching, the main sense is touching and looking. That's why the Torah says precisely the opposite, that you're not allowed to look, because the not looking The not looking means that you can't relate to it through seeing. You can only relate to it as a conceptual thing. And that was the chait. That was the chait, because it shows from there that even though they were happy to get the Aron back, but they were happy for the wrong reason, because they now thought they had the physical object back again. That's why it had to be sent to Kiryas Yearim. Then it said in Kiryas Yearim, Vayinohu Kalam. Then all the people flowed to the Aron, and then Shmuel was Mochiach them, and he taught them, and then it says, then they really did tshuva, and then it says, if you want to do tshuva with all your heart, then Asiru Me'alech, then you have to get rid of all the Avodah Zarah, and so on and so forth. So the process of tshuva had not been completed at this point. In fact, this was a crucial turning point. It wasn't just the return of the Aron. Because returning of the Aron didn't mean that they'd be on a higher level with regard to how they related to the Aron. But the destruction of the people of Beit Shemesh, this scared them. Then they really saw that they were afraid to keep the Aron any longer. They really saw there was something wrong with their own Madrega. That it's not just a pashta thing, the object per se, but it's your own level. It's your own Madrega. It's how you relate to it. That's what they said to Kirish Aram. And then there was a whole process, under the supervision of Shmuel, and that led to the tshuva. That's basically what I wanted to say. Okay. Because in fact, the pasuk says that Chafni and Pinchas were there at the time, and they went out. So they were punished Mida Keneged Mida, because they were corrupt. They were using the Migdash for their own purposes. So when the people wanted it, they didn't ask what the proper thing to do was. They just ran after the people. And that's why they were killed. That's what brought them out to the battlefield. That's why they were killed on the battlefield. Why? What brought them out to the battlefield? That same emotion. The emotion was their own aggrandizement. See, that's why they gave in. But the Abarbanel says that no. He says that they should not have brought it. Only unless a Navi, they should have asked a Navi. They should have asked Eli or Shmuel. Shmuel was a Navi. Or the Urim Batumim. Whether they had Rishis to do so or not. It was an impulsive thing. And the only reason why it was brought out was because of Chafni and Pinchas, who were corrupt. Again. Chib of Mitzvah.
That's using the physical as a means.
Chib of Mitzvah means love.
What's the difference between the
weighing up? And why is that permitted?
The ground is the same thing as the guy using the kozel.
Yeah. Well, the thing is like this.
They knew what they were doing.
So how would you answer that, Avi? A demonstration of love for an object of mitzvah, of course, is a very, very good thing. In other words, that's the proper. We should have a love of mitzvahs. We should have a recognition that the mitzvah that's obeyed may have. No question about it. We should. That the chib of mitzvah is a very good thing. Now, the only thing is how it's expressed, and with regard to what thing. See, the Aron. I would tend to think, I'm just speculating, that it depends on the nature of the object. In other words, it's an object which can be deified. You see, in other words, something which lends itself to deification, where there's a real danger of deification, so that has to be a law. You follow? Not everybody. You mean everybody that would look at the Aron would be on that level? Would be on the level of making an object out of it? No. But it's in other words, there has to be a category. It would depend upon. I would think it would depend on the nature of the object. You see, with certain objects, there was a too close. There's a danger. Why is going to worship the land? People live on the land. They walk on the land. I mean, it's like you see, they use it all the time. I mean, it's like it's not going to become deified. It's got to. In other words, you can't. It's got to be. Well, now, yeah, that system, the halachic system, did not consider every object to be in this framework. For example, the land itself. The land itself, no one's going to deify the land. He tills the soil. He uses the soil. I mean, when a person's involved in that kind of relationship, there's no deification. A person that's living in Israel, walking on the land, digging up the land, so on and so on, he's not going to deify the earth and the land. Now, for us, being in America, and we haven't been there for so many years, so, that process could occur. But we're talking about the system now. So in the framework of the system, certain objects had to be removed from that category because there was a danger that it could lead to that. When they kissed, was to demonstrate that's the love of mitzvah. That's a lot of. That's because there are a lot of mitzvahs. Because mitzvahs are pleased to earth. The system. The system itself. That's fine. But I don't think that, you see, in other words...
Endowing the object with the magical quality.
What are you going to endow the object with magical qualities? Right, exactly. That's what I suggest. It seems to be repetitive. So Rashi's position is that "Kosei Teilecho" means "Amelim b'Torah." That's a very important point, as we'll see later on. He says it must mean that because you can't say it means keeping the mitzvahs because it says "Yes mitzvahs tishmeru." So that's already telling you got to keep the mitzvahs. If that's the case, what does it mean "Kosei Teilecho"? So it means "Shetiu Amelim b'Torah." You should be Amelim means working very hard in Torah. Toiling, that's right. Then it gets, after the discussion of all the brachos, all the tremendous blessings, you know, because it means that if Klal Yisrael as a whole will be following the mitzvahs and then being Amelim b'Torah, you know, correctly, so then there'll be tremendous hashkach on Klal Yisrael. With all kinds of, they won't have any problems, any enemies, any wars, any famine, everything will be worked out to a perfect situation. In fact, Ramban says that this situation has never ever been achieved in Jewish history. Because it's a Tanai, in other words. The Jews are never on that level. And it'll be achieved in Yemei Mashiach.
Do you fight with one another?
I don't know. Oh, yeah. No, because that would be imperfection. That would be connected to Torah.
Okay. Wow. Good idea.
But the thing that Howie is referring to is like this. If you take a look at Pasuk Yedalad, then it goes into the Kolos. Chaf Vav Yedalad. It says, V'yim lo tishmu li, v'lo sasu, eis kolam mitzvah eila. It's called Mr. Sailor. Right? If you will not listen to me and you will not do all of these commandments. The imbechu kosei tzimasu. And if my statutes you will despise. The imes mishpat I tzik al nafshechem. And my judgments your soul will hate. Levilti asos is called mitzvosai. And not to do all my mitzvos. Lahafrechem is brisi. To destroy the covenant, then it goes into the punishments. Afani Yasas Lachem, and it brings in all the punishments. Now, you see that there's a list. You know, the Torah doesn't waste words. There seems to be an enumeration of different things that they will not do, the negatives. Right? So Rashi explains each one. Take a look at Rashi over here. The Yimlos Ishmaeli, Yud Dalet and Tesvav. We'll do those two Rashis. And Rashi enumerates all of the various things. It turns out, Rashi, there are seven things. And Rashi also says that there is a causal relationship over here. One step, the progression. So basically what we want to do is to work out, in other words, logically, why it has to be this way. What is the progression? So it says, Yimlos Ishmaeli, Leos Amela Matara. And it refers, if you will not listen to me, means with regard to being toiling in Torah. Okay? And then he goes on to explain, you know, from the Pesukim. But that's what his conclusion is. It means, the Yimlos Ishmaeli means that you won't be a male in the Torah. Then it says, what's the Yimlos Ishmaeli, then what's the Velo Sasu? Velo Sasu, Mishalo Tilmadu. Right? From not learning, from the fact you didn't learn, lo sasu. You won't do. Hare shte averos. So you already have two averos. Yes? I said it's not for the holy ship. You want to... what do you just want? Do whatever you want. V'yim chukosai t'masu. What does that mean? He says, Moes Bacher Ma'osim. He is Moes. What does this refer to? What is, in other words, Rashi is explaining. What does it mean? V'yemichukosai Timasu. What do you mean he despises the statues? So he says it means Moes Bacher Ma'osim. He despises the others that do it. Then what does it mean? V'yemichpatai Tigal Mafshechem. So he hates Chachamim. See, Rashi translates every general idea into a specific. What does it mean, levilti asos? Because this seems to be a problem, levilti asos. Because it already says velos asu. You see, so it seems to be a redundancy. In Pasuk Yedalot, it already said velos asu. Here it says levilti asos.
Matter of fact, isn't it like the same kind of redundancy we had by the positive side also, isn't it?
Yeah, see, so what does it mean? So Rashi explains. Monea esacher measos. Levilti asos doesn't mean that he himself doesn't do, but levilti asos, he acts to prevent it from being done, meaning through others, he himself stopped doing it already.
So there are two things. First, he's mowing from the people who do it, and then he tries to prevent
it. Yeah, well, Rashi will sum up the whole progression in a minute, I think, if you go along with it. Eskol, what does it mean? Eskol mitzvotai. Kofer, shalot zivisem. He's kofer. He denies. He says that God didn't command it. Lekach nemar es kol mitzvosai. V'lo nemar es kol mitzvos. The reason why he says es kol mitzvosai, because now he's kofer. He's kofer that God commanded the mitzvah. L'hafrechem es barisi. That's the last one. Kofer be'ikar. He's kofer. What does that mean, kofer be'ikar? What's everything?
The whole denies God.
Kofika means the essential. He denies God. In other words, the previous step was he didn't deny the existence of God, but he denies that God commanded them. The final step is the Kofar B'Ika. Now let's do the rest of the Rashi. Hare Sheva Averos. So you have seven sins. Harishonu Goreros Ashniya. The first one is Gorer, means causes. Causes the second one. Vechein Arashvias, and so on up to the seventh. V'yeluhain, and now he summarizes that. This is the progression. Lo lamad. First thing was he didn't learn. V'lo asa, so therefore he didn't do the mitzvot. Next, mo'es b'acher ma'osim. He despises the ones who do it. Next, sonei es hachamim. He hates the hachamim. Next, mo'nei es hachirim. He prevents others from doing it. Next, kofer b'mitzvot. He denies the mitzvot come from God. Finally, Kofar B'Ika. Okay?
Yep.
So now the question that we wanted to discuss is, what is the logic of the progression of it? How does it work? Can somebody say over the list, please?
Yes. First, he
didn't learn.
He didn't do it.
How does not learning go to not doing it? That's the first one.
That's not the first question. Yeah, why does Rashi begin with the not learning? Why is it not learning? Why is that the first thing? The first crack in these things?
You have to analyze why.
Well, this too. First of all, you have to analyze why that is the first step in the progression. And then you could ask, you might ask also psychologically why it's so. But according to Rashi, see, according to very few people would make this the center. If a person was talking about religiosity, the religious, what keeps the religious system, what causes the person to go away from it, right? It's very doubtful that he would say that he started off with the fact that the guy doesn't learn. That's very unusual. I mean, I'm sure he would talk about other things. He doesn't have faith, or is this, or that, his ego. And Rashi says no. Rashi says the first break, really the first break is the learning. Really there's one break. The truth of the matter is there's one break, there's the learning.
And that leads to that.
Yeah, because then that's the automatically
right.
Flow. So that's what we have to ask. Why does everything hinge upon learning?
I just wanted to make two observations. First the guy doesn't study, and then he doesn't do.
Yep.
And then he hates those who do, and then he hates those who learn.
Right.
The opposite.
Why?
I mean, in other words, he doesn't study and then he doesn't do. And then he should hate those who study and then he should hate those who do.
That's why he knows. Because psychologically, he has to hate those who do because he recognizes that it is the right thing to do. So in order to deal with his guilt, he has to hate them.
1 second, that's already 3 steps down the road.
No, Let's start from the beginning.
I know how you're asking a question which is a little bit anticipating. That's not going to help us now. We could, truthfully speaking, we could do that. We could go through all the seven and see whether we agree with the order. But since we're not up to that yet, and we don't know any steps, right? Let's say we got to step three. Then he'll ask, well, why is step four coming in? Really, step five should come in.
Okay.
Henry, what was your other observation?
I was also Monea es Ha'acherim, and it doesn't say Monea es those who learn.
All right. Let's start there.
That's the only thing that's not actually outside of the guy. Everything else is an internal thing. Every other staff,
honestly speaking,
also learning is.
You're saying you're saying the negative, that if a person. It goes away from mitzvahs, but if he learns, he'll do tshuva. But let's start it from the way Rashi has it. It would seem that, see what he's saying? The way I see it is that, see, a person only acts in his best interest, in what he perceives to be his best interest. Right? Because each person is in search of the good.
Mm-hmm.
And each person is selfish. So people basically live their lives in accordance with what they consider to be the best for themselves. Right? Now, a person, as we see from the whole progression over here, that by nature, the people have a conflict with mitzvahs, with commandments. The way the nature of man is, the way the psyche is structured, people have a natural resistance against the imposition of rules and restrictions on their freedom, on their instinctual freedom. And there's no doubt that the Tariag, the whole system of mitzvos, is a tremendous restriction, right, on a person's instinctual freedom. Correct? So basically you must posit that in the very nature of things there's going to be a certain amount of resistance against doing mitzvos. And it's not natural that a person is going to naturally love mitzvos. That does not come naturally. That is, of course, the objective. That's the ideal. But that's not the way things are naturally. Naturally speaking, I mean, you give a person a great meal, right? He'll love it. He'll be happy. That's natural. That's nature. You give a person a system of mitzvos, he's not going to ever jump for joy. Because it's not in his nature. It's not in his emotional nature to love that kind of thing.
Right.
That is only something that can be achieved. That can only be achieved by making a basic change. By creating a certain transformation. And what becoming involved in a different value system to the extent that the guy's emotions are affected. And the guy really loves to be, in other words, he attains a new object of love. But Torah per se, knowledge, learning per se, is not a person's natural love object. It can't be his natural love. It's not in his nature. That can only come about through a process of transformation. And I say that's why he used the term Amela Matorah. Why did he say Talmud Torah? Right? So Chazal say, come to teach us Talmud Torah, that you're learning. Because mitzvot is... Yeah, but they say, Amelim Torah. Not just, they use a special toiling in Torah. Why? They simply say, this refers to Talmud Torah. You see? The answer is, of course, Talmud Torah is a category. But even Talmud Torah can't be superficial. It's got to be a certain type of Talmud Torah. A certain type of his askos in Talmud Torah, right? Which affects the guy on the emotional level, so that then he has obtained a new object of love. That is the only way that you can solve the problem. The problem being the basic tension that a person is always going to be in a state of resistance and rebelliousness against any external form of imposition on his tivus. Which, by the way, why do most people that are not from? Most people that want the reason for the, you know, reform and so what's the whole purpose of this? They don't want any restrictions. It's a restriction. They want to be free. Beautiful restaurants out there. Different for delicious cuisine. Right? Not to mention other types that one can find in Midtown.
40
seconds. Yeah, I see. You know.
no, I haven't been there.
No. But not to mention that, and there's plenty of others, believe me. And it's not just that, there's other areas. I mean, so the thing is that Rashi is saying that ultimately speaking, a person, in other words, in the natural state of affairs, there is a certain tension. Right? On the emotional level, there's going to be rebellious against the mitzvah.
Rebellious.
Why? That stems from the instinctual side of man. The instinctual side of man wants freedom. Wants instinctual freedom. And rebels. Rebels against the authority. Rebels against rules. Restrictions. Ah. So if that's the case, if that was the whole thing, what's the foundation of the Torah? Would the Torah have no foundation? I mean, it would always be subject to being uprooted. The answer is that there's a resolution. But the only way the resolution can take place is on the level of reality. Because on the level of reality, the Torah is really man's happiness. It's the only way to happiness. In other words, if you understood the whole human nature, with the with the instincts and the fantasies, and why if a person follows his instincts and follows his fantasies, it can only lead to disillusionment. The guy can never be happy. Take a look at David Kennedy and all the others that have the opportunity, because of money or whatever it is, to just live out their fantasies. Elvis Presley, all these people, you'll see that it's an impossible. It's a road to destruction. But unfortunately, people don't realize that. People don't realize that because they don't think. And the emotion tells them, the Yetzirah, the emotion tells them that they should, this is the path to happiness. That they should follow the way of the instinct. And it's not in line with reality. In reality, the only way is through the system of mitzvot. But the happiness that comes from that is not the fact that man is in a state of deprivation. It's rather that this is the medium through which a person becomes transformed, right? And he becomes emotionally involved in a totally different value, the value of chachma. But that does not happen by itself. And that's why Talmud Torah Kineged Kulam. That's why it's a Melamah. Talmud Torah is the biggest channel, it's difficult mitzvah of all. Talmud Torah is the most difficult mitzvah of all the mitzvahs. Why is it the most difficult mitzvah of all the mitzvahs? Very simple. See, any other mitzvah is a Maisa HaMitzvah. See, every other mitzvah is a means, it's a means to perfection. It carries certain ideas, it's a reminder, it's a symbol. You know, there's different types of mitzvahs that operate in different ways, have a different effect, right? And some are harder than others. But at all events, it's just an action. You see what I'm saying? The most difficult, whatever, I don't know what you, some people might have more difficulty with some, let's say a sukkah, you might find very inconvenient living in a sukkah the whole week. You might find it very difficult. Some people enjoy it. You might find the Yom Kippur to be the most painful thing. Whatever it is, it's limited in time. It's a certain action, right? You can observe it. You did it. Now, it's not constant. The person is not constantly... Talmud Torah is a transformation of the Gavra. Talmud Torah requires a basic transformation from his whole method of functioning, because his energy, his whole energy system, is naturally rooted in the instinctual. See, a guy can suspend temporarily. That's why a guy goes to shul. People go to shul. You know, it's painful as heck. That's why they talk about business, this and that. You know what I mean? But they suspend. All right, they put that. In fact, they enjoy having a little pain. You know, like relieves guilt. They feel good. But then they're afraid. Then they go home from shul and they're free. Talmud Torah means to give up. To give up the way of the fantasy. To give that up. And to make a transformation. To change your basic values. Your loves. Your enjoyments. You see? To direct your energy into learning seems to be the most difficult thing of all, I would say. But that is the ultimate. If a person cannot make that transformation, so then he remains on the level where he's in total conflict with the mitzvah system. Because he's on the level of the instinct. And on the level of the instinct, all of his values are determined by the emotion. You see? And since that's the case, he's in a conflict, because his fantasy, he's always fantasizing about taiva, and then he has to observe the restrictions of mitzvah. See? That's the first thing. Alright? So if he doesn't succeed, so what happens next? What happens next?
He doesn't do.
Yeah. By the way, I'm not. You say I'll tell me there are people that don't learn. They do, right? Or they. You have to know how to take this kind of a thing. You understand? Rashi is not. There's many. Rashi is giving you general ideas. All right. He's not talking about specific people. It means that the failure to learn will lead to a failure in doing. Now, how, to what extent, and what person? It means that there's a certain relationship, a causal relationship. You have to take it that way. There could be other factors. A guy could be keeping it for different reasons. Rashi's pointing out to you that there's a cause and effect relationship over here. How that will set itself up in various individuals, right? And whether that could be affected by extraneous circumstances. I mean, a guy could be doesn't learn at all, and he keeps the mitzvahs because he was brought up in this community, or it's because his business will suffer. He has a kosher bakery; he's making a fortune. So if he stops keeping the mitzvahs, people won't buy. I mean, there can be. We're not talking about that. Also, how many he'll give up? The guy might keep prison; he'll give up everyone. Rashi is just telling you that as a natural result, there'll be a break in the mitzvah. That step is, what's the explanation of that? Jeff? How does that work?
Well, what if you don't understand this as being for your own benefit? You're letting your emotions have to stay. Why should I be doing it?
Yeah, because we said a guy has to operate with the for the good, for himself. Right. He can't. A guy's not going to live a total life of denial of the good. Right? Right? So if he's involved in Torah, so then of course emotionally he's attracted to the Titus, and his emotions tell him this is the good. But when the guy is Osek and he's involved, like you said, when he's Osek, constantly Osek, you see, and he sees the truth, he sees the ideas, so then he sees that's the reality of the good. So then he goes by that and he overcomes the Titus. But when the guy is no longer involved in the learning, he doesn't see that as the good anymore. And then the emotional thing becomes powerful, and it tells him that that's the good. Eventually, there's going to be a break. He's going to start to do it because that's the way. As we said, there's a natural resistance against the restriction on the time. Right? There's a desire to follow the good. He's going to go after what he wants. There's got to be a break. There's going to occur a break. It may start with one mitzvah. It may be in a certain area, but the it's going to affect his observance.
Yeah, he can't do it because when he does the mitzvah, then it's conflicting his whole view of it, and it will break him down.
Not
he's
that.
Having in a struggle because he's learning and saying it's not good, but here he's doing it anyway. So
that's very good.
Himself.
That's very good. Let's hold up. That step comes in. You see, I think the first two steps, it's easy to see. In other words, as we said, once we posit that the basic system goes against the natural state of man right. on the instinctual level, right? Lives his life in accordance with the pursuit of the good, what he perceives to be the good. You see? So then, the Torah can only be seen as the good by the individual, provided he goes through this transformation, which is a difficult transformation to make. And if he can't achieve it on that level, that means he's given by the way. That itself shows. Why can't he do that? Why can't he make the transformation? Because he gives into his emotions. And it's more than just, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The very, it's not just that A, he doesn't have that good, so B, he will follow his emotions. The reason why he couldn't make that transformation shows the weakness in the Gavra. It shows that he can't master his emotions. The reason why he did not succeed in learning is because he followed his emotions. His emotions told him to take it easy. So there's a Gavra that works by his emotions. If he's a Gavra that works by his emotions, so then it's going to happen that there's going to be violation. He's going to stop keeping, he's not going to keep that system. Yeah. Now the next step, okay, you have a couple points that work together. Work together. In other words, even if it wasn't the absence of Talmud Torah, right? So it makes it the deck is now stacked against the there's a conflict there, right? The natural conflict, the natural resistance, you see, and there's a desire to pursue the good, right? If a guy doesn't have Talmud, he doesn't do that as the good, then the emotions will tell him to. That's A. B. Moreover, the Gavra is another fact. The Gavra is already an emotion. You see, he's already a Gavra that's controlled by his emotions. That's one of the reasons why he couldn't get Talmud Torah in the first place.
Yeah.
But that's a separate point.
Okay, fine. No, just in regard to B itself, that's the hardest one. Yeah, but maybe the easier one that he could do. They really can't show it. Talmud Torah is the hardest one. So if you came to the hardest one, doesn't mean
that
it's the easier one.
Yeah, but I'm trying to show you, yeah, of course. I said it is the hardest thing. I explain why it's the hardest thing. But I'm also explaining to you why it's central. Why it's, somebody says it's the backbone. It's the backbone. Now, why is it the backbone?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Now, I'm telling you why it's the backbone. It's the backbone. Now you see the Talmud Torah, Kineged Kula. You see quite clearly it changes the Gavra. Oh,
yeah,
the Rav. We'll see. That's one of the Rav has a whole shiur by Halachli. It's a different Gavra. Halachli. When a guy learns Torah, it's a different Gavra. It's a key in the Gavra.
Right.
That's a very important. That fits in beautifully with this philosophy over here. You see? As we, Talmud Torah is Kineged Kula. Talmud Torah is on a different level. It's not just another one of Tayyar. You see? Oh, it's the whole foundation of the system. It's the whole kiyum of the system. Because that's the purpose of all the mitzvahs is to achieve a certain type of, a different type of a gavra. What is that difference? All right, there's many. I didn't cover every aspect of the difference, but primarily it lies, right, in what this gavra perceives to be the ultimate enjoyment, which is Chachmas Hashem. You see? Now that's a difference. That's a change. That is Shinui HaGavra,
right.
Psychologically, because we said by nature, By nature, that is not the gavra. By nature, is an instinctual gavra who values the tithes. To have another gavra who values the chachma is shini hagavra. In reality, it's shini hagavra. It is a different gavra. And what is that mitzvah of Talmud Torah? The mitzvah of Talmud Torah, really, the ultimate is to transform the whole gavra into a different kind of gavra.
And he's a better
person. Oh, for sure, that's happening.
In line with reality.
That's in line with reality. That is the only happiness that man can have in this world. It's the only life of happiness man can have. Anything else is going to be, because the way the man, the Adam, is set up, since he is set up differently than the animals have a different concept of happiness. What's happiness for an animal? I mean, happiness for any creature means to be in line with its own nature. So an animal is instinctual. As long as it's not prevented from being in line with its own nature, it'll be happy. You take an animal that likes to go free, you put it in a little cage, it'll be unhappy, it'll be miserable, because it can't fulfill its nature. But it fulfills its nature by instinct. It doesn't require any free will. Any thought or any free will. Man is the only creature that cannot find happiness by nature.
By nature? You don't say his mind has to be instinct,
his nature? Now, by nature, by instinct. Oh, wow. Free will. The use of the mind is an act of a free will. He has to transform. He has to use his machshava without thought, in other words. Just by pure instinct, he's not going to... if he follows his instincts, he will not be happy. Why? Because he's not a creature of instinct, per se. He's a special little bria. Selam Alekim, that means both instinct and Selam Alekim. So his formula, what will make him happy, has to be one which fits his nature, since his nature is different than the animal's. You understand it clearly?
Okay. I mean, what did you say about in the second step, when a guy stops doing mitzvahs? You said a guy who lives according to his taiva.
Yeah.
What was the point that you made there?
Now, I'm saying that once a person does not make this basic transformation, right? So then there's going to be a tremendous force to not to keep mitzvahs. That leads to the why will they keep mitzvahs anymore? Because now mitzvahs are in total conflict with his perception of the good. Because he lives on the love of the emotional, and the emotional tells him this is the good. So a guy is not going to live his whole life in deprivation of the good. I mean, it's to be expected, right? There's going to be a breach. It's going to lead to breaking of mitzvahs. Some people, the thing is like this. As I said, don't confuse the theoretical with the practical. Because people, some people, well, which ones? Were the ones that are most in conflict with their emotional. Those are the ones that they may keep some, because those ones that they keep are not in conflict with their emotional desires. You follow?
So
but you see the process, though. The cause and effect, but you don't see it.
Someone who has some authority.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, is it that he has all his...
Then the keeping of the mitzvah is in line with his nature. Because his nature is that he values the intellectual.
He needs the good. He has to get the good.
See? So every mitzvah is purely in line. Every mitzvah he enjoys. And he sees this as the good. The mitzvah, in other words, the mitzvah is in line with his nature. But if he does not have Talmud Torah, then the mitzvah is not in line with his nature. The mitzvah is totally connected. Because man by nature is an instinctual creature, right, that goes by the illusion of the fantasy. And we said, to make the mitzvahs in line with nature requires a transformation of the gavra, shini hagavra. Is that clear? Yesy? Okay. Yes?
This includes that guy who just learned, let's say he goes to shiur once a week.
No, a melem b'torah.
Not a melem b'torah in that case.
See, Rashi realizes a melem b'torah. Well,
he's just the guy who happens to.
There's different degrees. I can't get into. Well, let me put it this way. I'm talking in purely abstract terms now. When you try and translate this into the practical, it becomes very, very shady. There's very, very many shades. You know what I mean? A guy can know. I'm telling you, we shouldn't. A guy can come to. They're up. You don't realize. And a lot of people are really value learning, even though they don't learn that much. They may come once a week, but they have a certain value for it. It's not so partial.
Also, guys who come once a week and they don't value learning, they come because of other things.
Well, then that's not learning. That's what I think.
That's
what I'm
saying. It's just another one of the mitzvahs.
I think. Oh, yeah, you're right. Very good. No, I know what you meant. I'm trying my best to avoid any deprecation of individuals. You know what I mean? I mean to say that Rashi did say Amelim. Chazal say Amelim b'Torah. So to me that indicates a certain quality of Limud HaTorah, right. One which has the capacity to affect the Gavra.
Right.
The guy goes through the rote. That's why he didn't say Talmud Torah. See, if he said Talmud Torah, it would mean the mitzvah. Like this. Your point is good. If Rashi would just say Talmud Torah, so you'd say, oh, he does the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Oh, to be Yosef, the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, you learn a minute in the morning, a minute in the evening, and Yosef. That's why Rashi didn't use the term, because Rashi didn't mean Talmud Torah just to do the mitzvah. He meant a certain involvement in Torah, a melem of Torah, quality of Torah. What's the third step?
Third step is that he's hates the people that do it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hard. Why would he hate the people? Now that's the third. Now we got to get into a little psychology.
Yeah,
psychology.
The second one causes the third one.
Well, and you tell me. You have the facts here. Goreris, right? The first one is Goreris. The second one, V'chein ara ad hashiva. Doesn't it mean now that the second one causes the third one? There's a certain causal connection. So then, what does he do? He hates. He hates the ones that what? That do it. Why is that? Why is that, Jeffrey?
Well, I hope I don't misquote, but. Ramaphosa said a number of times that that a person has almost a natural feeling for right, even if he's not living in line with that thing. Let's say a guy is not into learning and he lives totally according to his instincts. He is in conflict simply because naturally he has a certain instinct in terms of what is right and what is wrong. Not an instinct, but like something psychological. I'm not sure exactly what it is.
Well, you're on the right track. There's no question about it.
Through that, once you say that, really the guy sees, the guy unconsciously may see that what he's doing is not the best way. And he'll see that these people that are doing it may be the right way. So he hates them only because they represent the thing that you really should be doing.
Okay. That he's living the correct life. Right? He has a superego. He has to feel that a guy can't walk around feeling that he's totally living the wrong life. Okay. Now, the thing is like this, that there is, even though he has resistance against the mitzvahs and all that, like you said, he did experience, right? He did try it, whatever it is. A certain part of him holds that he's wrong. Now, the thing is, and that's why he's moes b'acherim. Because, you see, one step further, this type of a guy is affected by his reality principle is now affected by not right, but by society, what people are doing. You see? In other words, as long as there's a group of people, because if it's just pure guilt, so then he'd feel bad, even if there was nobody else doing it. You see? So the thing is like this. The thing is, how does it work like this? He's moes b'acherim. He hates the others who are doing it. How does it work? Because when he perceives that others are doing it, it arouses his own guilt. And his own guilt means his own self-hatred. In other words, he looks down at himself and these people are superior and you're inferior. Right? Now, a guy cannot stay. That's an intolerable situation for a person to be in. It's intolerable for a person, right? It is intolerable for a person to go around in a state of self-hatred. He can't take it. So what does a person do in that situation? He projects it onto the other. See? So he hates, the hatred of the other is really a projection of the hatred of himself, which is aroused when he perceives there are others that do the correct thing, which a certain part of his mind holds to be the correct thing. See, they make him feel guilty, inferior, and therefore, he can't say that he's wrong. So they must be wrong. So he hates them. He has to hate them. Exactly. That's the natural consequence. And this is the whole psychology behind anti-Semitism. Derek Wall.
Yeah. There's also another factor in addition to guilt. I would say this identification. In other words, he does not want to be identified, associated with these people.
Created with them.
Of course, because
why?
The
so why does he hate them? Don't want to be associated. So stay away. In other words, it's very easy not to be associated with them, but it's an act of hatred. He has to hate them. He must hate them because otherwise it means they show that he's a real failure. And he can't admit he's a failure. He can't admit he's a behemoth, he's an animal, right? So therefore, these are crazy people. These guys, there's something wrong with these people. Go ahead.
This will take
a job for us. See, since he can't, he's not involved in Chachma. He lost in the battle for objective reality. The knowledge. He lost. He gave into the emotions. When you give into the emotions, so the emotions also have what's the reality of the emotions recognize? People. The guy that lives according to his emotions doesn't have a system of thought, so for him reality is what he lost public opinion. For him reality is really what? What people are doing. That's what most people, right? Isn't it true that most people say, how could this way be right?
the whole world, everybody else, that they, you know what I mean? I mean, this is a very powerful force that most people, they judge reality in terms of the subjective. Why? Because that's all they recognize is the subjective. So what people think, the more people think a certain position, that makes it right. Of course, in reality, they don't do that.
If that is true, so somebody today is religious and then gives it up, right, for whatever reason.
Yes.
Should not feel animosity towards those who are religious.
Will feel animosity.
Should not, because they'll say, look at the
world. People in conflict with that. The reality, there is a part of him that senses that he feels guilty. In other words, there is a reality principle. If the guy had no reality principle, that, you see, even the Goyim, why the Goyim hate the Jews? Take a look at the millions and millions of Jews are a little dot on the thing. Millions are Christian and Islam, whatever it is. Because they sense that the Jews have something. They still can't escape. They can't escape the Sinai. You see? So Kavachama, the Jew himself, who was raised, definitely knows that the other stuff is nonsense. He knows that that's total nonsense. That's not going to make him... Of course, I mean, he does derive some comfort from that. That's his rationalization. There is a side. Both of these factors operate simultaneously. I agree with you. But he will hate the ones that do it, because as long as they are doing it, it's a rebuke to him. It's a reminder that he is really... he can't take that. He can't take that. Because he's not a thinker. If the guy was a real thinker... Let's put it this way. We're not talking about a guy who's a real thinker, right, and work that whole system, and so it's a false philosophy. That's not what we're talking about. A real, honest philosopher that just happened to come to the wrong conclusion. He wouldn't hate the guys who do the mitzvot. He would not hate the guys. Now, tell you, a guy that was really, you don't have too many like this, but a guy that, say, was a Bertrand Russell type, that was just operating with philosophy.
Yeah.
And he worked out a whole philosophy. A brilliant thinker, but he happens to be wrong. And he came to the conclusion that it doesn't make any sense to keep the mitzvot. If he was a true philosopher who just happened to be wrong, he wouldn't hate the Yosef Mitzvah.
You don't think Bertrand Russell would be indifferent?
He'd have a sympathy to that. Bertrand Russell did have hostility to Christianity. He had hostility because he held that the thing was really, really pernicious and wicked and immoral in terms of man. And also, he may have had some personal because he was raised and he hated it. So he had personal, but also philosophical hatred, because he held it was really a terrible thing. A corruptive thing in man. That's a rational, and he happened to be right. It's a rational, his hatred of Christianity was rational. It wasn't because he gave it up, he thought it's absurd. I mean, like, you know, that's he was anti-religion.
In general, all religions?
I think so, yeah, because, he didn't know about Yadis, and in Christianity he held it totally crazy, so you gotta give a man a lot of credit. The Christians that don't hate the Jews? What do you mean?
I'm saying that's why there's anti-Semitism. That's why
the root cause of anti-Semitism is jealousy. That's for sure. Now there are Christians. Yeah, there could be different factors. I mean, there are many, many. You have to look into it. I would say the most from of them are the haters. You see, there are many Christians that the Christianity is not a real part of them. To them it's nothing. They don't really, it's superficial. They just go into a thing, it's religion, it means very little to them. And decency means a lot to them. You see?
Tomorrow,
so they, what? Tomorrow, yeah, so they don't have this, for example, you see, we're going to have to conclude this next week anyway. You can work on the rest of the steps, by the way, once I get you started. What's the matter, you know?
I'm not going to be here.
Nothing, now you'll postpone your trip. Tell you, call your parents and tell them that you just have to lay a little bit of his ear. You notice that the Scandinavian countries are much less anti-Semitic. For example, in Denmark, they were really like the Vikings.
They really were
most inefficient to save the Jews. In fact, the king, Wallenberg, is in one person. I'm talking about the nation of Denmark. There's a couple of books on this, interesting books. When the Nazis came into Denmark, so they came out with a decree that they have to hand over the Jews. And the Jews have to wear the yellow star. Mm-hmm. So first of all the Danes, they didn't hand in any Jews. They hid the Jews at great risk. And the king himself wore the yellow star. It's a famous story. It's two stories here. The king himself.
It was a cool guy.
That was a real tzaddik. Denmark was a real tzaddik. It was all of them.
Were they religious?
Well, I think it's a Christian country. It's not a Jewish country. So... And the Scandinavian countries in general were not as rabidly anti-Semitic as like Eastern Europe, like Poland and Hungary, Romania, where they
We are just as bad as the Nazis.
They were worse than the Nazis.
Worse than the Nazis.
3 million.
Che once on said a possible reason. I mean, it's hard to like, you know, you. It's just a thought. You can't. Yeah. Really. But he said that historically we know that Christianity came to those countries much later. Meaning to say that the countries where where Christianity came earlier and it was much more rabidly, fundamentally,
England,
fanatically Christian, they were more. England too was very. Except England, see the thing that changed England, Lechatchila was they drove out the Jews in the time of the Rambam. They were anti-Semitic. The other thing is that in England they also had a certain process of democratic development over the years, which counted. You see, you follow? In other words, there's two things: there's the emotion and the anti-Semitism. But then, if the country is set up as a democracy, so then there's in America, there, believe me, there's plenty of anti-Semitism, but it's a democracy. So the two things balance each other. Whereas, he wanted to say that in these countries like Denmark, it came very late. Christianity it came much later. So the whole relationship with the people, the Christianity wasn't such
Denmark
a strong thing.
The people there. Were
yeah, but it's a different. You know, they had a different relationship. Like, you know, you're asking every front. I mean,
in
general, like they're being. Not 5 more years. It's many, many years. It's a difference.
There's a difference.
That means that since it came later, it set itself up in a different way, and the results are different. It's the whole thing.
There's a difference.